Well, I pressed one.
And then we're recording.
Okay.
Good afternoon, everybody. This is Joel Whitaker, the editor of Cane's Beverage News Daily. We're talking with Gary Heck, who has some tremendous news about Korbel. The company is celebrating its 130th anniversary. That is good news in itself, because most companies don't last 130 years. And the really exciting news for Gary and for us is that Korbel sales are up 13% in the first 9 months, I believe it is, against a year earlier. So, Gary, obviously somebody is doing something right. What explains the success? You can take all the credit or you can share it with your staff.
Well, I've got good
yours.
Joel, I have good staff also. I've got tremendous people working for me here and also Brown-Forman. But I think the reason we're up is we have been doing this now for 130 years, and we're consistent. Every month we have a different program going on with the advertising, the promotions, the cross-merchandising. Now, we're up about 105,000 cases through to October 23rd. November is our biggest month of the year, and that's normally around 300,000 cases alone, and then December is about 145. So even though we're up, you know, I'm hoping it holds most of the year, but, you know, it could slip a little bit because of November is so big. But anything up in this marketplace is a success.
Yes, I would agree, and I think a 1% or 2% thing would be viewed with pleasure, and a 13% increase is really very, very good. You guys should be very proud of yourselves, especially when we look at some of your competition. Cooks is number two. You have the largest market share. Cooks is number two with 10%, and Andre is number three with 9%. How did you get this 13% share? What have you done?
Oh, well, I think it's because we're consistent in our advertising, our promotions, and our programming. You know, Joel, we're an icon brand. Korbel is known by everybody. Everybody in the United States, anyway. I don't think France really does want to know it too much, but they everybody knows Korbel. We probably have 98% distribution throughout the United States, on and off premise. You know, off premise is much stronger, much bigger, because we are that price range where we're affordable luxury. Mm-hmm. And the other thing, Joel, that I think is important is if you look at those slides again that Margie sent you, where Korbel is 13% market share, that's of the total sparkling and champagne industry in the United States. If you look at just method champenoise, which is the only way we produce Korbel, we are over 55% of the method champenoise sold in the United States. So that's saying something pretty nice about Korbel.
That is saying something pretty nice about Korbel. Brut and dry, Brut and extra dry, I should say, together account for more than 50% of the market. What explains the success of those two categories for you?
The dryness of when my dad bought the Korbel, they only made Sec, and then he came out with Brut, and then all the rest of the brands. But Brut and extra dry has always been the mainstay of Korbel. It's what we feature in all of our advertising and promotions. I mean, it's the one that gets most of the attention. It's the one that we do all of our promotions with. It is the brands that we supply the most of.
And do you think this, well, obviously this explains or represents the taste of the American public, but why do you think they prefer the drier product versus the sweeter product?
Well, Joel, it's interesting because we've been having Brut and extra dry and natural and Chardonnay champagne, and as you know, we got like 17 different champagnes. But what I have seen lately is the expansion of the sweet side. We've never had a sweet champagne before. 2 years ago, we came up with a sweet rosé, and last year we came up with a sweet Cuvée, and they are really, really doing well. They have the fastest growth percentage growth of any of the rest of the brands. They're up 20% in over 2 years.
Interesting. And what do you think that says about the American public?
You know,
I'm asking you to play psychologist here, for which I can apologize because you're a marketer, you're not a psychologist. But
no,
it has to be a little bit of thinking about that sort of stuff. So, what do you think? What do you think it says?
Well, I think it says that the youth of this country, and we didn't realize it when we were growing up, and of course my dad certainly didn't, because he was very, very traditional on dry champagne, not sweet.
Not sweet.
Mm-hmm. But it seems, Joel, that we grew up with, iced tea sweetened. We grew up with Pepsi sweetened. Coca-Cola, it's sweet. I mean, we grew up with sweet. And I think the younger generation is sweet, and I think that's why there's the cocktails that we're doing with champagne cocktails. Those are sweet, and they just seem to be coming around.
True. And certainly other cocktails in many cases are being made sweet, too, if you will.
Yes.
I tend to be, when it comes to distilled spirits, I tend to like vodka, and I like it without a lot of flavoring, but there's an awful lot of effort to create sweet flavored cocktails, and my 23-year-old daughter certainly is on that bandwagon, I'll tell you.
It's the younger generation is drinking sweeter than you and I grew up on, Joel. We grew up with our parents teaching us to drink dry.
Right. And do you remember, maybe because you're in the wine business you don't, but they used to say that, if you were a real man, you had to learn to be able to drink your whiskey straight and so on and so forth, which... today, that's the other approach. They want it sweet.
Yeah, Jack Daniels and Coke is a pretty big item.
Yep.
I mean, I drink Jack Daniels on the rock, so I do drink it dry, not with any flavorings added to it.
Right. I guess it must be a generational thing.
It could be.
Yeah, at any rate, Korbel is now the number 3 wine brand above $10 in grocery sales. Grocers are awfully tough people to deal with. I mean, I know some grocers, and everybody I've talked to who deals with grocers, it's all about the numbers, and, you can rent shelf space, of course, but, they really want products that are going to move and move well and move quickly, which makes them tough people to sell to. How have you managed to become the number 3 wine brand above $10 in grocery sales?
I think that's because of what our brand is, and I think, Joel, to explain it, I think is on the focus groups and all the testing that we do, the brand I can trust, the brand I can give as a gift, the brand that I can afford. We're an affordable luxury, and we're in that price range. And when we're in the grocery stores, we have 15, 16 facings where our competition does not. Now, if you take another brand that I own, like Kenwood, there's thousands of Chardonnays out there.
Mm-hmm.
And thousands of wineries out there. There's not that many brands on the champagne sparkling side. So we command a more space per brand, all of the brand. I'm not just talking about Korbel. Our shelf space, Domaine Chenin, all of them have bigger shelf space than you would instead of finding 2 bottles of Chardonnay of Kenwood.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And they're brand sets, too. That's the other thing that's important about this champagne sparkling wine category. We are brand sets. You'll go to a store and you'll see all of my Korbel brands on the shelf. When you go in and you find a Kenwood or somebody else's, you'll find 2 Chardonnays. Then you go down 6 feet and you'll find 2 Sauvignon Blancs. Then you go down another 6 feet and you might find 2 Zinfandels. You don't have brand sets. It's very difficult to build a brand that's not brand set.
Very interesting. I had not heard that before, which simply tells you what a bad marketer I am.
Well, Joel, it's just the visibility. When you got 8 or 9 brands sitting there of all your own, all say Korbel, it's a billboard effect.
Sure. And I was about to say that reminds me of one of the reasons why some other brands have become so successful in other beverage categories. I mean, I know down south, Coca-Cola, when I was growing up, every twinkie little small grocery store had a sign with a Coke, logo on it, and it would say, Gary's Grocery or something or other, and of course, Anheuser-Busch with Budweiser did exactly the same thing. They just slapped their brand on anything that moved. So I think I do understand now exactly what you mean, and I also understand what you mean when you talk about you're so consistent in your programming with something every month. You just keep your brand constantly in people's minds, I guess, at all times.
Top of mind is our advertising philosophy. Toast Life is another one of our slogans. The sponsorships that we do, the TV. I mean, we are out there and being very visible by the public.
Mm-hmm. Talk to me for a moment about your advertising approach. You do TV, obviously. Do you do a fair amount of print? And if you do a fair amount of print, where do you do print?
Well, most of our media is TV. TV and social media is big now. We do a Spanish magazine called Alma, and we do some trade magazines, but that's all we do in magazines. So our footprint in magazines is very, very small.
And
outdoor, we have two outdoor directional boards to show you how to get to the winery, but that's all we're doing, billboards on the Champagne side. But most of our media is television and social media.
And that is because you found the TV works best for you, or?
It has for a long, long time. I think the first commercial we ever did was 1965. And, it's just something, Joel, we've been doing every year. And, you know, I know now there's a lot of comment out there about, well, geez, you got a television, you've got 350 channels. Back when you started, you only had three, ABC, NBC, CBS, mm-hmm. and maybe a public broadcasting. You know, now you've got 300-400 channels, but I think it's still working, and I'm afraid not to do it.
My friends in the TV business will be happy to hear that. And I understand where you are too, because if it works, you know, what's the old line? Don't mess with success, or something like that. So.
Yes. And we're sticking with the TV, but some of the new stuff, which is way over my head, this social media stuff. I've got people that just concentrate on that 100% of the time, and you know, doing the Facebooks, the tweeters, and all that stuff. They know how to do that. I don't. That's not my generation.
I'm with you on that too. I fully understand where you are. Talk to me a little bit about sponsorships. What sort of sponsorships do you do, and why?
We do quite a few of them, but let me give you the main ones. We do the American Century Celebrity Golf Tournament up at Tahoe, and that's around July. And we get NBC is the TV company that handles that, and we do special spots with them on that. We do the, it's now called the Tyco Golf Skills, which airs in December. It used to be the ADT Golf Skills. That's where you get it's like 16 professionals out there that closest to the pin, longest drive, you know, out over water, out of the trap, and they get so many points for each skill they do. We do, and also in December, we do the Birds of Prey, which is up in Colorado. And then we do the Corbell America Ski Classic, which is up in Colorado also, in Vail. So those are the main ones we do. We do also do a lot of local sponsorships.
Interesting, though. It sounds to me like most of your sponsorships, or many of them anyway, are golf-related.
They are. Golf and skiing, and, you know, we get access to network during that time that we're – that is not our main buying TV time.
Uh-huh. I was interested in that just because, in my mind, you know, Corbell goes, or Champagne period, goes with weddings and that sort of thing. And so I would think you would be, you know, advertising something on the Ski Channel. But no, you're out there in mainstream media on NBC with big, huge events.
Yes, we are. And, you know, just on the TV alone, Joel, we spent about, this is not including making the commercials or any of the other parts of it, we do about $5.5 million in TV buy.
That's a
pretty significant buy for, you know, it starts week before Halloween and runs through Valentine's Day.
And I guess that's a key period for you, huh?
Yes, it is. It is. 60% of our sales is SOND, September, October, November, December.
Really? 60%?
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, it's that's a big part of our business, Thanksgiving through
February, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's quite a number. How about on and off premise? What do you do there?
Mostly off. On premise, we got our fair share. It's probably about 10% of our business is on-premise, but 90% of it is off-premise.
Mm-hmm. And do you do anything special to drive the product in the off-premise stores? I guess we already talked about that, didn't we, with the brand sets in the grocery stores. And that
yeah,
sort of.
And, well, we also do a lot of cross-promotions. We're legal. You know, uh-huh. dollar off coupons, we're legal.
Uh-huh.
Mail-ins, we're, you know, we do those quite a bit, too. But, you know, buy a bottle of Corbel and get $3 off on roses, that type of stuff,
mm-hmm.
or other food items. We do that. We do something different about almost every month on that.
Again, to create, I guess, excitement and keep the brand constantly fresh and all that sort of thing, and drive sales according to what you have found works in a particular month.
Yes, be in everybody's face at the same time.
I like the phraseology, Gary. It's nice. How about Hispanic customers? How are you marketing to them?
Well, we are doing TV, some TV on Telemundo and Universal,
mm-hmm.
Univision. I'm sorry, and also Alma Magazine. That's we started about 3 years ago doing television with the Hispanics, and I'm trying to remember the name of the guy that we do the. Can you say that name, Margie? I can't.
It's Don Francisco on Sabada Gigante. It's the number one Hispanic variety show. It's been running for probably about, 20 years. And the MC of that show is like the Ed Sullivan of this programming. And so we've been sponsoring that show for... about 5 years
yeah,
now?
Yeah.
Very interesting. And how have you seen your Hispanic sales go? I assume they've been increasing.
They have been, and we also do a lot of cross-merchandise in areas of the country that are Spanish-speaking.
Mm-hmm.
Texas, Florida, you know, it's all... But you got to be careful because you have to use the right dialect.
Right.
You have to... If you're going to do it in Florida... Get somebody that knows the Florida Spanish speaking people. You don't want to use San Diego.
I hear you. Yeah, because that would not play well at all.
No, and Sweet plays a pretty good role in the Hispanic also.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Interesting.
Yes.
Tell me a little bit about Corbel. The company itself is 130 years old this year. How did it get started, and how did you and your family get involved? You said your dad bought the business at some point. Tell me about
yeah.
that.
Yeah. Well, I'll give you the five second tour,
okay.
I can send you the whole history too, Joel. But let me. The Corbel brothers, three of them, came over here from Czechoslovakia in the late 1850s, 1860s, for the logging. They were loggers. And
really?
they bought all the property around here in Guerneville, Monterio, the whole northern area here where it's all redwood trees, for the redwood trees and the Douglas fir. And they cut most of them down. And they had a mill out here in front of the winery, which is our parking lot now, was the mill where they made all the beams for many of the buildings, including some of the major, like Greystone in Napa, was from the Corbel logs.
Mm-hmm.
The Corbel winery here has these huge beams in them that were milled in this log. But then they also had a cigar box manufacturing company in San Francisco that they made the redwood cigar boxes for.
Mm.
And once they cut all the trees down and did all their lumbing, they didn't know what to do with the land. So they tried prunes, apples, pears, tobacco, believe it or not, in this cold climate. And
right.
Yeah, it didn't work. Anyway, none of those did really too well other than the prunes did okay. The apples were a little too cold for. And so they went to the University of California and asked them, what could we plant in this land out here? And they took soil sample, and they brought the temperature readings in, that it's very cool, damp, kind of wet area. And they said, grapes. Plant grapes. You're kind of like the Champagne region of France. You don't have the snow on it, but you have cold nights and early fog in the morning, you grow champagne grapes there. You'll do better off with champagne grapes than you would wine grapes. So that's how they started putting in the Pinot Noir, Chardonnay, and that kind of stuff. And then in 1954, my dad, who at the time was president of the Italian Swiss Colony, which was the largest winery in the United States, decided he wanted to go out on his own. So he found out that Tony Corbell, who was the nephew of Francis Joseph and Anton Corbell's nephew, put the winery up for sale. And Dad went down to San Rafael, knocked on the door, and bought it.
Very good.
In 1954.
Obviously, he knew a good thing when he saw it.
Yeah, he did. He did. My grandfather, who ran Cook's Champagne in St. Louis, really wanted to buy Corbell before he died, but he didn't live that long, and he died, like, I think, 52 years old. But my dad came out to California, worked for National Distillers at the time that owned Italian Swiss Colony.
But it sounds like your family has had its eyes on Corbell for a long time.
58 years.
Amazing.
Yeah.
What's been the key to the success of Corbell in those 58 years? That consistent programming, or what would you say if I wanted to get into the wine business, and I wanted to copy what you did? What's the key to success?
Well, I think my dad's vision was basically being at the right place, the right time, and the right price.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of sparklies that are much more expensive than we are, but Dad really wanted to have his champagne fruit forward, dry, elegant, and affordable, and delicate. Not heavy Frenchy, yeasty style, but light and delicate. And I think that was the thing that the American people like about Corbell, that it's crisp, it's light, it's delicate, it's a tint of apple flavor to it, and pear, but it's really an easy beverage to consume.
And
in moderation.
Yeah, got to add that, right?
Right.
Yeah, it is. It's a pleasure. Tell me about you yourself. Obviously, if your dad bought the winery, were you alive when he bought the winery?
Oh yeah, yeah. Yeah. I was like 7 years old when he bought the winery.
And you moved from what, San Francisco down to wine country?
We moved from San Rafael, which is where we were living in 1950 to 1953, and then moved up here to Corbell in 1954 when he bought it.
Okay. And I don't suppose that was traumatic at all for you because you were only seven, so.
Yeah, I don't remember much of San Rafael.
Yeah, excellent.
But I did, Joel, I have done almost every job there is to do at Corbell, from auto mechanic, picking grapes, pruning, making wine, running the traffic department, running the doing all the shipping, purchasing, everything, vice president of sales, executive vice president, president, and now chief operating officer, which means I'm chairman and president,
right,
and owner.
And which one of those jobs did you enjoy the most?
Executive vice president.
Why?
The reason I say that, because I worked very closely with my dad, who was president, and we were more than – it was really not – we didn't really – we had a father-son relationship, but really he was my best friend.
Mm-hmm.
And he taught me everything in the business.
How nice. How wonderful. What's your relationship with Brown-Forman?
It's a tremendous relationship. We have been with Brown-Forman for 47 years, and they are one of the key reasons – Joel, for the success of Corbell. Jack Daniel's is an icon brand. They're a family company. Even though they're publicly traded, we have a wonderful relationship, and it's been long-term, 47 years so far.
Before you linked up with Brown-Forman, were you doing your own distribution, or were you using national or somebody else?
We had, on the East Coast, we had 21 brands, company, and on the West Coast it was called Parrot and Company. They also, before we went with Brown-Forman or Jack Daniel's back in those days, they were East Coast and West Coast and not too much in the center of the country.
Mm-hmm.
And Brown-Forman, Jack Daniel's also with them, but then Jack Daniel's left them in like 1962. Formed their own national sales company, and then came to my father in 1965 and said, we can represent and want to represent Corbell, throughout the United States in every market. And Dad said, okay.
Sounds like a winner to me. If somebody came with that same proposition and I was basically on the two coasts, I would say, let's go.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's almost a no-brainer. What are the biggest challenges you face today?
Oh, I think the biggest, other than Mother Nature, I would say the biggest challenge is taxation. Excise tax increases. I mean, the government really hurt the industry in 91 or 90, whenever they took that last excise tax increase. That hurt the whole wine industry for about 5 or 6 years before they ever even caught up. And what I think that the government, state and federal, forget about a lot, Joel, is that when you increase taxes on a beverage, you don't get increases in revenue because you're actually lowering the volume. And it takes a long time to come back after a tax increase to get the volume back up.
And do you think that we're facing that today, or is that just the ongoing challenge?
It's an ongoing challenge. I haven't heard a lot of rumors about it yet. But, you know, with the economy the way it is, everybody's looking for where am I going to get some more money?
Yeah, well, exactly. I know that I haven't heard much either in the way of real discussion, but I know that the trade associations here in Washington are all concerned about that and have been very busy promoting the message you just talked about down on the Hill while the members are out. They've been talking to staff because this is a great opportunity to get real time and real attention from people like the chief of staff to a congressman or a senator and those
guys. The Wine Institute, which, you know, represents the wine industry, does an excellent job at lobbying for us in D.C.
Good.
So does Discus and WSWA, too, for that matter.
Yeah, they do. I mean, you know, all these associations, I think, really do a good job. Some years one stronger than the other, but, you know, looking at it over a 10-year period or something, they're all very active, and they usually work together, except where their interests diverge, and, you know, you would expect that.
Yes.
What are the biggest opportunities you see for Korbel and perhaps for the wine industry as a whole or the sparkling wine industry as a whole?
I think our biggest opportunity is to grow our brands, but to grow them healthy and grow them moderately. I don't think anybody... 13% of it is a scream for us. Like I said, I don't know if that'll hold through December. But, you know, I think with the industry growing as it is, and if you look at the total California industry, let me get my paper here, Joel. The total California industry is up 17%. The bulk process is up 20%. Method Champenoise is up 10%. We're up 13% of that 10%.
Mm-hmm.
Imports, France, Germany, Spain, Australia,
all of them,
are only up 1%. So I think our opportunities as an industry and as Korbel is to be out there and get market share.
Sure. That makes perfect sense. So if you're looking to get market share, does this mean you're looking to hire more staff?
Not really. Staff here at Korbel is interesting. For an example, if we need a new building here for warehouse space, we'll rent it for a couple of years first to make sure that need is really there, and then build it. Because what you don't want if you're out in Guerneville is have an empty building. There's nobody else that needs it out here.
I can believe that that's what you don't want to have, and as a matter of fact, I can believe that's what no businessman wants to have for very long.
No.
You know, and
but
and
if
I've
we need more, Joel, if we need more staff, we'll find it.
Yeah. But right now, you don't have any pressing need for it.
No, not right now. We're pretty full.
Okay, that's interesting, and I suspect that's good. Gary, excuse me. Pardon me for that cough. We've had a great chat here. Is there anything we didn't ask that you really wish we had?
No, I don't think so, Marge. Can you come up with anything?
No.
No, I don't think so, Joel. I think we pretty much covered everything, you know, the history, the my involvement. I think we pretty much covered just about everything you wanted to know.
Great. I guess that means I did my job for once, which is always a good thing. So if you'll stand by for just 1 second, let me wrap this up for the recording, and then we'll chat for just 2 more seconds on just purely bureaucratic stuff.
Okay.
So, Gary, thanks so much for your time here. We appreciated it. It's been a great interview, lots of good news, and congratulations again on that 13% increase, which I think is really very good. And I think it may indicate to some extent that, along with those other figures you gave about the domestic industry, that perhaps the economy is starting to turn around, which would be a good thing for all of us. We wish you a good time, and thanks to our listeners for listening, and we will talk to you again very, very soon.